Hey, good morning.
Morning, Rabbi.
Hey, Jim, how are you?
Very well, Rabbi. How are you today?
Okay, doing well, thank you. So I guess we'll wait a minute until they're ready to join, and we'll start the new chapter 11. How does it sound, Jim? All right?
It sounds
great. You still you come in low on a regular basis. So you, what type of phone are you using?
I'm using a VTech, but so that I can mute myself and so I can write. I have a headset. Sometimes I don't speak up loud enough to be picked up by the microphone, I guess.
Oh, but the mic is pretty close to your mouth, though.
I just got a new headset because the old one was really low and nobody could hear me at all when I was speaking, so I was hoping this one would do better.
Right.
I take it it's not, though.
Well, right now it's okay. But I do recall in the past, though, it was much lower, so maybe this one is better.
I'll work on projecting.
Yeah, maybe move the headset. Doug, good morning. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good. How was your week last week? I know you were busy.
Yeah, it was tiring and wearing, to be honest. But
yeah, I could imagine.
I was very happy to...
What did you say? You're happy to get home, you said?
Yeah, I was gone for 12 days.
Wow. It's a long trip. Where did you go to?
Let's see. I ended up at Arlington, Virginia for about the first week, and then a few days in Philadelphia and a couple days up in Manhattan.
Gotcha. You travel more than the president?
Well, I hope not. I had to be, I had to be on the East Coast 2 weeks. And it didn't make sense to fly home at the end of 1 week and turn around and fly back at the beginning of the next week, so I just decided I'd hang out over there.
You probably recharge your batteries a bit, too, over the weekend.
Yeah, I tried to do that.
We did last week the class on what we discussed on abandoning Torah, so I think we really gave it a very good treatment. So it's online on the last week's date.
Oh, good. Thank you. Yeah. I'd like to go back and listen to that.
Yeah, we went through it really thoroughly. I was just, like, really happy. And I guess I shouldn't have been surprised, but, you know, there were two opinions that we initially started with. Maybe it's going back a month now. And it ended up that the Torah addressed both the opinions that you and I both had. So it was just a pleasant thing.
Well,
you know, that the Talmud itself actually is really doesn't miss a beat. Yeah, it was very, it was really something, just to see it right there in print. It's very debate that, you know, that we had. It was like right there showing both sides are true.
So did that end up answering the question of Maimonides as well?
What was that question?
The question about near the end of busy working on behalf of the Jewish people that he only had time to learn just a little bit on Shabbos.
I guess he had to do that. There was really, didn't have much of a choice. And, but I'm sure that, you know, it applied to him, that second part where he was talking that if a person, you know, has a woman on his mind, so she waits for him as long as she knows that he's still thinking about her. Meaning the woman is really wisdom, and the person is, you know, the real individual that has got her, meaning wisdom, on his mind. So wisdom waits loyally for that person. So as soon as he has the moment to get back into it, there's no two-day period where he has to, you know, reacclimate himself. It's since it's always in the back of his mind, and he never loses the ability to jump right back into, you know, his wisdom. There's no reacclimation period. So I'm sure that applies.
Rabbi.
Yes.
This is not Sean. I was going to say, couldn't you say also that since Rambam was dealing with people on a daily basis towards that latter part of his life, that really he was a day-to-day basis. He was actually applying Torah too, and so that would have kept his mind fresh. Even though specifically on Shabbat he would have dedicated himself to intense study, but he was actually applying Shabbat on a daily basis. Torah on a daily basis.
You mean because he was treating people in the path of Torah? He was following the Torah's principles. Yeah, you can see that too. That the person that's following the principles of Torah. So although his learning is not on his mind, but his the principles can also have an effect where it keeps him in tune with his wisdom too. I would agree to that. Yeah.
Good morning, Rabbi. I'm listening also.
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
All right, so is everybody online? We have Jim, Cal, Carolyn?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Ruth Goodell.
Okay. All right, so Doug, you'll take a listen to that when you have time, and we'll talk it further, but I wanted to make sure that you knew that we took it up.
Yep, I appreciate that.
Sure, yeah. All right, so we're going to start today with a new chapter on Kehelis, which is 11. And, okay, so let's start. So King Solomon says as follows. Cast your bread upon the waters, because in many days you will find it. Cast your bread upon the waters, for in many days, or in the length of days, you will find it. And the next verse he says, give a portion to seven and also to eight, because you do not know what will be the evil on earth. Give a portion to seven and also to eight, because you do not know what will be the evil upon the earth.
That,
okay, we'll elaborate. There's a number of commentaries on that. Okay, so it really is cryptic, and it really is not too comprehensible without looking at the commentators. So what we'll take up today is Rashi, Ibn Ezra, Sforno, and also what is entitled the Talumos Chachma, which means like the hidden wisdom. That was the name of the commentary. Okay. So Rashi says as follows. You should, when it says that you should cast your bread upon the waters, he says as follows. You should do goodness and kindness with man to a person who says that his heart is upon you, meaning he says that I'm relying on you, and do not fear her, do not fear any further, like a person who throws his bread on the face of the water. And when you throw your bread in the face of the water, it's basically gone. And it goes on. And he says, and in the length of days you will find it. He said, there will be further days that are coming in your life. And you will receive the reward. Look what happened by Yisro, Moses' father-in-law. He said to his daughters who came back after Moses had saved him at the well, and Yisro said to them, where is he? So he told his daughters, go call him and he'll eat bread with us. And he considered that he was an Egyptian at that time because he was dressed like an Egyptian. And that's what the daughters told to Yisro. The Egyptian man saved us from the shepherds. And then Rashi says further, v'lo yirenu od, you shouldn't fear any further. What would be at the end of Yisro? What happened at the end? He became the father-in-law of the king, meaning his daughter Tzipora married Moses, and he became the father-in-law of the Jewish king, of Moses. And he became converted and came under the wings of God's protection. And he merited that his sons and his grandchildren should dwell in the temple. Very nice story, but what's Rashi's point? So Rashi seems to be saying that he seems to be giving he's explaining the verse that you should be this generous. And what will happen will be that it will meet you at the end, just like Yisro had seen good from his kindness. He shared his bread with Moses and ended up that look what happened at his end. So how would you describe the message of the verse just based on this? Well, it seems to be the verse is saying just the opposite, no? He says that the verse, if you just read the verse, it says, cast your bread upon the waters, because in the length of days you will find it. And Rashi says also, it's the first part in Rashi, he says that there are still days coming that you'll receive your reward. Ibn Ezra, however, and Sforno both say what you're saying, Doug. Let me read them. What Ibn Ezra says like this. He says, send your bread, cast your bread upon the water. That a person should be careful, if he has the means, that he should be generous in spirit, and his hands should be open to those who recognize him and to also those who don't recognize him, meaning stranger and friend alike, he should be generous to. Sforno says, you should give without any thought of reward. Exactly like you're saying, Doug. And don't cease to be generous by casting your bread, to do good to others besides you. And he says a reason, and he says, what does it mean that you will find it? What does it mean that you'll find it? So Sforno says, you'll establish for yourself a good name as one who's good to everybody, and you will find graciousness in God's eyes and also in the eyes of men. So Rashi takes the point of that it'll be something which you'll receive reward on. And he actually goes further, whereas Ibn Ezra and Sforno are saying that you should give graciously regardless. And Sforno says clearly, without any intent for reciprocation from those who you benefit. The Rashi says, no, he says that In the length, because what does it mean you will find it? What does it mean the end of the verse? Because in the length of days, in many days, you will find it. It'll come back to you. You receive reward for what you did. But he says,
is Rashi saying that? Is he actually saying something different than Ibn Ezra, or is he saying the same thing in different words? Meaning, if he says, no, go ahead and cast your bread upon the waters, and after many days, you know, you'll get your reward, is he saying, like, you know, you'll win the lottery or something physical will come back to you, or could he be saying the reward is you will have developed a good name and good character and so forth? In other words, the same thing Ibn Ezra is saying.
Well, it seems that he's saying that what it means that you will find it eventually, that there will be yet days that you will receive reward.
And I guess I'm asking what, for us, at least my major reaction is that reward means like, you know, money or something monetary, but could it be that he means the reward is, you know, you have developed a very positive character. In other words, kind of the same end result that Ibn Ezra's talking about, and it's not about something sort of quasi-magical coming back to you.
Yeah, that, first of all, that's Sworno, if I didn't clarify that. It could be. I'm not clear. It seems to be like when they use the word in the Hebrew, tashlum, that sounds like reward in terms of the real spiritual benefit. So it means, you know, because that's really what, you know, the Torah talks about in the morning prayers. We said that there's certain commands that they have the real essence of it waits for us in the next world. Meaning, it is the benefit, it is the perfection that we achieve, but that results in the real eternal good for our soul.
I was going to say, Rabbi, that sounds like they both Sforno and Rashi agree in a sense, but both of them with regards to rewards, but they're different type of rewards. One's a physical reward, you know, and one's a spiritual reward, because, you know, we learn from the Chazal, the sages, that a reward, you know, one mitzvah leads to the next mitzvah, so maybe that's where Sforno's coming from, that's really what our reward is, whereas Rashi's more thinking in terms of here in the physical realm. But they're both rewards.
Yeah, you're right. Rashi does talk about the physical realm, because he gives the analogy of Yisro, of Jethro, his life was he became the father-in-law of the king, and he enjoyed coming under the God's providence. So it's here on earth. In terms of, you know, well, Doug, you were touching on you're going to win the lottery. That's I mean, it could be. I mean, it could be, if that's what the person really needs. God can reward him that way. Now, is it a providential thing that it's talking about? Is it something which is just natural? Like, I sound like Doug, you were saying that it's just the perfection the person achieves. And if that's so why is it at the length of days? It should be right then and there. If a person is generous with his bread, with his money, so then why is it at the end of days? But the verse clearly stays, and we can't veer away from the verse. The verse says, because in the abundance of days, in the length of days, you will find it.
Are you asking why it's abundance as opposed to length, or why doesn't the reward happen immediately?
Yeah, if it's something, yeah, exactly. Why is it? It should be an immediate thing if it's the perfection of the person, right?
Oh, I would make an argument against that like this. If I go do 20 push-ups
I won't be strong. But if I do 20 push-ups or whatever every day for the next 3 years, then it will have a huge change in my body. So giving of charity one time may make a small minute change, but one who does that over a very long period of time makes a character development change.
Okay, I see that. That's true. I mean, it's not an individual, a discrete act.
Right. It's the...
Yeah, Rashi would back it. He says, actually, maybe that's what it means in the second verse. That he says that you should give your portion to 7 and also to 8. What does it mean, 7 and also to 8? So Rashi says, divide your bread and your drink to in 7 ways of acts of kindness. Meaning 7 different people who need it. Right? And even to 8. To an 8th person that comes along, don't say you gave enough already. So it's a sustained act, like you're saying. So that's what, the two verses are clearly linked, but now it seems from what you're saying, it gives us insight into how they're linked. That first verse is telling us what you must do, but the second verse is telling us the way that it has to be a sustained behavior.
Rabbi?
Yes?
I'm sorry, this is probably a really simple question, but I have a problem with the metaphor in verse 1. Is this a fishing metaphor? I mean, who throws bread on waters? Is this, you know, you throw the bread, you know, bread out there to attract fish, and then you're getting the haul? I don't understand the metaphor itself.
No, there's no fish involved. It's a matter of meaning scattering your wealth where it's that's good that you bring in the question. It's not talking about fishing, but it's talking about how I think I saw somebody who spoke on this. Yeah, the fourth commentary might be addressing what you're saying. He says like this. He says this is really a warning to a wise person. That if he sees that his generation is not accepting rebuke, nonetheless, he should still rebuke them. And bread is a euphemism. It's an analogy. It's a metaphor to Torah, to instruction. So he says you should be careful that you should warn. You should warn and you should teach the right path to the people, even if you think that it's not going to help this generation. And you think that you're throwing your teaching to a people like a person throwing bread on the water, that there's no benefit. Just throwing your bread on the water, that's it. It gets softened up and it disintegrates. That's why he says, this commentary says it's an analogy to a person that's trying to teach a generation that just doesn't want to hear it. And he says, therefore, I say, and a person might say that there's no real benefit to it. But he says, no, don't think that way. Because he says, it's impossible that what you're teaching won't enter the ears of at least one man over the length of days. So he reads the verse that you should cast your words, even though you may think that you're rebuking people who aren't going to listen, but at the end of days, you'll find it. It'll find some person who will hear it. So he says, don't think that it's a useless activity like throwing bread on the water. So he takes the whole thing as an analogy to a wise person that has to the responsibility of telling others what they should be doing in terms of the path of life.
Kind of interesting, Rabbi. I don't know why, but I'm thinking about, when we bench, at least in the Sephardi version, towards the end, there's a reference to a righteous person never going without bread that Hashem will always provide. So I kind of see a tie-in with this, like you're saying, because you know, Hashem was always going to supply his need. If we were associating, I never thought about this, if we were associating bread with Torah, you know, the Torah is always going to come back to us. I don't know, I kind of see a connection there.
Well, that's what he's saying. Yeah, he's saying that don't feel that by teaching it's not going to have some benefit somewhere. He's saying that's just not the nature of how society is. You may have in your time that, you know, generation that people are just not going to listen, but somehow it's going to be passed on, and somebody's going to hear it, and they may verbally say it over, the person may write it down, and a guy 10 years later will find it written somewhere, but it will have a benefit, and don't be concerned that you don't see anything right now, because it could be over time it'll have effects. So that could be what that could be understood as you're saying that, you know, it'll come back to you. It will have, so your intent will be filled somehow. But you see that Rashi is clearly talking about it coming back to you. And we have to explain why he has to say that, as opposed to Ibn Ezra and Sforno, which are saying that don't be concerned about getting reward. Even people who don't recognize you, like Ibn Ezra says, and like Sforno says, even if you don't see any type of recompense for it, do it. However, they both are going to have to address the last part of the verse. It says, because in the length of days, you'll find it. So how do they understand it? So Sforno says, what does it mean you're going to find it? It means that the act that you do of being generous with your wealth and then giving to those who need, that will be something which, number one, finds favor with God. That means that you're doing a perfected act. So that's really perfection of yourself. So it could be the length of days means that you reward the next world. This is something which eternally perfects your soul, as long as you stay on this path. And eventually it also will, people will see this about you too. So it'll be something that you enjoy here on earth too, that the fact that people recognize that you do good is something which has a benefit in the length of days. And there's also a verse that talks about this. It says that, Rabbi Chaitwin explained, it said the name of the wicked will rot, but the remembrance of the tzaddik will be for good. So what does it mean that, you know, in both cases this is something about, you know, it's a certain individual and there's a certain relationship that people have to them. So what does it mean that the remembrance of the tzaddik, the remembrance of the righteous will be good? So Rabbi Shet explained, because at the time of the tzaddik, the righteous person's life, when he's rebuking people, or even if he's just living a good life, it will awaken the jealousy and the animosity of people who aren't living the right life. Because by comparison, they're going to feel of lower status, because they see this righteous person living properly, whereas they are not. So they don't like the righteous person, because it reminds them of their inadequacies. But when he dies and the person is gone, now all that's left is the memory of what he did. Then the remembrance of the righteous person will be for good. Then there's no more personality that is opposing me. Meaning, if I'm a free-for-all type of person, and every single time I see this righteous person in town, it bothers me because I know he's living properly and I'm not. So while he's still alive, I'm bothered by his personality. But once he dies, meaning his remembrance will be for good. Because now that the person is gone and I'm not confronted daily, now it's just the actions per se that are what I remember. And there's no personality around anymore that is bothering me. So the negativity is lost and all that's remembered. I mean, the remembrance of the righteous person is good, because it's only after he's gone that I could objectively see what he did was great. But while he was alive, his personality opposed mine.
So are you saying that, and just in general, somebody's more apt to take something to heart after somebody has passed on, as opposed to, you know, when they're in the present?
Yeah, a person who is not living the right life will have that type of relationship. He's bothered by somebody who reminds him of his inadequacies, of his shortcomings. It's a natural thing. Because the person, that's what it says, you try to rebuke a foolish person, he'll hate you. He doesn't want to know that he's inadequate. But that's only while your presence is there in front of him. So it's a competitive type of a thing. But once the person is gone, the competition's gone, and now all that's left is the fact, what was he doing? He was doing what the Torah says to do. A foolish person won't call the Torah wrong. He'll call a person wrong, because that's closely related to him. There's a different phenomena. So, but the abstract Torah, he says, yeah, it's right. I'm just so that's what the righteous person becomes after he's gone. He's no longer there. Then he's purely just like the Torah. There's just, what was he doing? He was doing certain good acts, and those good acts is what the Torah says to do. So there, he can no longer have resentment. So that's why the remembrance of the righteous person is for good. While he's alive, it's competition. It directly bothers me. Whereas the person who is the wicked person is just going after all of his enjoyments and everything. So during life, everybody wants to be around him. They think, oh yeah, I'm going to get some of his money. If I'm really good friends with him, maybe he'll share some with me. He'll invite me to the party. I'll enjoy some of this hedonistic lifestyle. But once he's gone, that's why it's the reputation of the wicked will rot. Then once that person who's wicked is gone, now they recall his acts. He was just a lowlife. He was just a hedonistic person. So it's similar to here. We're talking about that in the abundance of days. So then he'll find graciousness in God's eyes and in man's eyes. That's a swarno. But you see that he has to address this. This verse is being addressed because there's a need to address it. What's the need? You always have to ask, what exactly was this purpose? What void was this verse filling? Evidently, there was a need for King Solomon to write this. That's always one of the most fundamental lessons, fundamental questions we have to ask whenever we have a verse. Well, why is he saying this? Who is he saying it to? What's the real need to address?
Rabbi?
Yes.
I think my question about the metaphor helps answer that question. The sort of charity we're talking, or it seems like because you cannot see how you would get paid back, right? I mean, because the bread going into the water does seem so useless, right? This is why this metaphor is so difficult to understand. It's not like planting. You know you're going to get a harvest. Right? You're
yeah.
Something absolutely useless, and you can see that there could not possibly be any benefit to that. And so you have to be told that there will be rewards because you couldn't possibly deduce it.
Okay, good. So it's addressing the concern that person is going to be dwindling away his possessions. And you see that you have this guarantee again in Malachi, where God says, there's one area God says, and test me please in this. And he's talking about charity. He's talking about giving. And he says, test me and see if I don't open up the storehouses of heaven until you have such, I'll empty out the blessing for you until you have more than enough. You see, there's one area that God understands human concern, and that's the person works very hard for his money, and then he's told also to give it away. He's told to be charitable. So there God says he gives a guarantee to man. Because that's the one area that a person will have the most difficulty, is to part with what he's earned and just to risk having less than what he really needs. No matter how he has an equation in his mind, he could have $1 billion in the bank, but giving away is now makes that sum that much less. So that risk, God says, I'm going to allow a person in one area to test me, and I'll respond. And you see that King Solomon's following the same thing here. He's addressing that concern. He understands that people have a concern. It's a natural thing, and therefore he says, you'll find it at the end of days. Because he's addressing, that's the unspoken concern in this verse, and that's what that's responding to. He's telling you do this, and he's also telling you that you'll see it'll come back to you. All right, so maybe in a different sense, But Rashi takes it literal, and he says even further. He says on verse 2, apportion now to 7 and even to 8, because you don't know when the evil will come upon the earth. What does Rashi say on this? He says exactly this point. He says, in a different sense, but you'll see what I'm saying. You don't know when the evil days will come. He says like this, perhaps there will be yet days that you will need all of those people that you supported, and then this will save you through the charity that you gave. And if you don't start doing it now, when are you going to do it? So he says it's sort of like an assurance. It's a smart idea that a person shouldn't be an island. He should be generous and share, and this will have real practical effects that'll benefit him later on, because he doesn't know what the future holds in terms of his own income. People lose jobs in this economy left and right. And maybe you're going to really need somebody, but if you were not there for them, why should they be there for you when you're in need? So Rashi is telling you, according to the plain reading of the verse, too. That's what they read verse 2. He says, give to 7, give it to 8, meaning give to a lot of people, because you don't know when and where the evil is going to happen on the earth, meaning while you're still here on earth. You don't know what the future has in terms of your own monetary needs. So be wise.
But aren't you giving them with an ulterior motive?
Yes.
The correct way to give?
That is still a good idea. There's a number of good ideas in the verse. One is of course, like Sforno and Ibn Ezra says. Like Ibn Ezra says, give to people whether you recognize them or not. Or Sforno says, give people without any concept. That is a true idea, meaning the goodness that you should want for yourself, give to others. That's the highest level, of course, where you recognize others as no less than you. And when you see somebody in need, you feel you really empathize. You don't want to be in that situation, so why should you close your eyes to their need? So that's Ibn Ezra and Sforno. But Rashi's saying there's also another benefit. And Rashi's 100% right. And there's nothing wrong with it. He's saying practically. It's a good idea to be generous, because this can help you in the future. And a person does live in a society, and there are politics that a person has to play with. Of course, a genuine friend is not going to turn away from you, even if you never help them out. A real genuine person that is living on the right level is not going to say, hey, well, what did you do for me now that you're coming and you're asking me for something? Of course, it's the highest level. But there's also the practical level of how people operate. And knowing that, it's a good idea. That's why, a king is very wise to... what did King Ahasuerus do? He gave wine to all of his viceroys that was older than them. So what did he do that for? He was giving them wine, but he also gave them wine that was older than they were. And I thought it was a very clever maneuver why he did that. He gave abundance, too. There was no limit. But you think about it. You see, number one, what you're doing by honoring your viceroys is you keep loyalty. That's an important thing. That's a practical thing. So there you're doing it for an ulterior motive, but that's a good ulterior motive if you're a king. You're a person in power. But there also has to be a certain respect that the king commands, because he knows ultimately he has to make the decisions, and he needs, all the soldiers to line up behind him and not to challenge him. So that's why I believe he gave wine in order to impress them, to honor them, and to, make them loyal. But in order to keep them in check, he gave them wine that was older, meaning when they drank it and they had the wine, there was a humbling effect. This wine is older than I am. So that has a certain effect on a person, meaning I wasn't always here. There's a humbling effect to that. It's a clever maneuver if that is, in fact, what he did. So it makes the person humble to the king. At the same time, it compliments them because he's treating them, he's inviting them to a personal affair, private, for dignitaries and officials. So, we when we study the Torah, we look at all of the realities, and that is reality. And what did Jacob do when he was being chased by his brother Esav? He figured out he's got to cover all the bases. Of course, he prayed to God to help him. He didn't just rely on miracles. he prepared a gift to try to win over his heart, because his life was being threatened. But he also, when he approached him, he bowed down to him, he called him master, he was very politically correct. And you see what happened? That Esav, according to one view, was overcome with love, and it really worked. So why was Jacob doing it? Did he really feel that Esav, the warrior, the hunter, was worthy of this honor? No. But there was a practical effect. It says also, I remember Rabbi Chait saying that that whole story was studied by the rabbis before they ever had to encounter the governments that they lived in, because they looked at Jacob as being like the chief politician, the chief psychologist. He understood more than anyone how to deal with people. And that's a very important thing. If you really want to, if you have an objective that you see is a good for you in life, for you, a lot of times you have to change your attitude. What did King David do when he was amongst his enemies? He acted like a retarded fool, dribbling saliva from his mouth. And when they saw him, they said, this is the king of Israel, this can't be him, we have the wrong person. So he put on his a completely different personality, because he knew that would be something that would save his life at that point. Yes, you have many cases. All right. Okay, so we did it with Ezra. And he says what? That you should have your hands open, and you should be generous to whether you recognize the person or not. Meaning, do it for the absolute good. And as foreigners is the same thing. Don't look for any reward. And he says, what? Right, so that's the Sforno. We did the Rashi, we did Ibn Ezra, we did the Tlilus Chofma. Okay, it could also be now in verse 2. So he's telling you again practically, and don't just be kind to one, be kind to many people. And very simply, because you don't know when you're going to encounter days that are going to be difficult, and you'll have the need for them. And that's Rashi. So Rashi's saying a very practical state. So there's a number of issues, and of course the underlying consideration is because the person has a difficulty with parting with his wealth. But you see that there's going to be reward from God. You may have a need for yourself, and there's many benefits to doing this. All right, so let me see if any of you have any questions or comments on this.
Rabbi, I might have missed it, but was there any significance to the terms 7 and 8?
Rashi didn't say. It was just meaning a lot. But Rashi did go on, and he said that another explanation that the rabbis bring down, that you should give a portion of what your wealth is to seven, representing the Sabbath. That you should have, take care of that day, that you have a day of rest that's pleasant. Eight means that you should also be involved in circumcision. He says further that you should give a portion to the seven sacrifices of the masses, of the 7 days of Passover, and also to the 8 days of the holidays. Meaning that you should be involved in Shabbos, circumcision, and the holidays. So he brings that down as being significant too. To answer your question, there's another explanation of the rabbis. And evidently he's saying this because these are staples in terms of the identity of the Jewish nation. The circumcision and the Sabbath. And the holidays, recalling the Creator as well as providence, because we always say that Sabbath represents creation, that God made everything. But that might make a person think, yeah, some philosophers held that God created the world and walked away from it. He's not governing it. So that's what the holidays represent, is God's constant providence over the nation. and he saved them from Egypt. He gave them the Torah on Sinai. He gave them the tabernacle, the huts to dwell in, and or protected them with the clouds, depending on the interpretation that you use.
I'm just wondering if that's something that's sort of interpreted after the fact, or if King Solomon was thinking all that at the time that he put those numbers in.
Could be. That's what the rabbis are saying. That there's an underlying, there's another. I mean, there's more than just one idea in the verse. Okay, any other questions or comments? Okay, so we see how the two verses work. It's telling us what to do and how to do it. Right, that was actually in response to your original question, Doug, your observation. That it can't just be a one-time act, but sustain it. And also, practically, if you give a lot of people, this is something. So a person should not be thinking only in terms of on one plane. There's a perfection, but he has to understand he's living in society, and there is a benefit. When you may have needs. So certain people, you don't have to do this. You don't have to butter them up. You know they'll be there for you. Because you have such a long-lasting friendship, and you have the common bond of living the right life together, and you will be there for them no matter what. You'll treat them just as you treat yourself, right? You'll love your brother like yourself. That's a command in the Torah. But we can't be ignorant to the fact that certain people do have emotions. Many people do, and it's important how we treat them. There may be something that they can help us out in the future. So we can't just... be confident, he's my best friend and he'll always be there for me. Be intelligent, and that's what one of the primary messages here is telling you. That's Rashi.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Rabbi, I think what you said before earlier in reference to how you judge how to treat somebody else, it's so simple really that you said it's how you'd like to be treated. If you give a donation to somebody, if you give help to somebody, you have to put yourself in that place. If they're really desperate, if they really need help, and how you would feel when not and having shame to ask, we should have to wait to be asked. We see the need, we should try to help.
Right.
And that's with everything, and that's one of the things that you had said, and I think that sums it up.
Yep, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what we'll do is we'll continue, and next week we'll go on to verse, we'll see how, if there's a tie-in or if there's a new idea, verse 3. And we'll pick it up from there. And again, if there's any questions or comments even during the week, you know how to reach me. You can send an email in or a call. So if there's any follow-up, I'm more than happy to do it like we did a couple of weeks ago. And it really, a lot of times during the week, there's even more that we discovered than just in the 1 hour that we have in the session. So, please feel free. And it doesn't have to be on this topic either, anything that comes up. And I try to be timely about getting back to people on emails. So please feel free, all right?
Okay.
All right, everybody. So I wish you a good week, successful week, and learn well. And everybody should have a really fantastic week.
Thanks, Rabbi. You too.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
My pleasure.